Session number 12913.
Mr. Bellows, reel 3.
Well, just afterwards, we moved back into Palestine because the Australians had come over by then, and my battalion had the job of helping them to settle in and build their camps and goodness knows what. Of course, the Aussies had about as much discipline as a crate of, well, I don't know what. They just had no discipline at all. Their officers, they called them whatever they liked to. They just wandered around like, well, they pleased themselves or appeared to. But they were some really nice chaps. One night, a crowd of them went into Jerusalem and they saw a unit of the Black Watch, or some of the men of the Black Watch who were also out on the town. And of course, they had their kilts on. And some of these Aussies went round them and started putting their hands up their kilts and trying to be clever. Of course, people don't realise that in those days the average height of a Scotsman was about 5'6". 5'4" to 5'6". They were a very small race. But people just can't, or they don't know that this was an actual fact. Now, the Aussies cleared the jocks out of all the bars. But the next night, the Black Watch turned out in force. There was a battle royal, and they cleared every Aussie out of Jerusalem.
Out of where?
Out of Jerusalem. Jerusalem was a no-go zone for the Aussies until they called a truce with the jocks and accepted them for what they were. Now, another funny little thing was that we also had a lot of the yeomanry had come out from England. These still had horses.
Is this in Palestine?
In Palestine. And these still had their horses. And they were, the yeomanry were more or less farmers and what have you. And they were more like a private army than anything else. But they were good. And with them came the Army Veterinary Corps. Now, with the Veterinary Corps, they had quite a few jockeys that had been called up. Never seen anything like it in my life. There was these little men with ammunition boots on, size 3s. You could pick them up with one hand. I'm not a big man, but these were little men dressed up as soldiers. When you saw them out during the day when they were on duty, with 3 horses each, riding one on either side and a rifle slung across their back, they were funny little men. We used to love to go in the wet canteen with them and have a drink, and they'd get on the table and sing. And they enjoyed themselves as much as we did. Then, of course, back we went again to Egypt. Then we went to Moascar. Now, again, we were training, looking after an Italian prisoner of war camp. with the civilians and ship's crews in there. This was rather interesting. Then there was an RAF base there, and there was Wellingtons used to fly out from there with like a big ring underneath them that used to fly over, and apparently they were mine detectors. Used to detect, or I don't know if they set them off or what they did, but a lot of chaps had the idea that they attracted the mines and they stuck to the rings. But this wasn't the case. Now, Moasca was quite an interesting little place. But from there, we went out to various places on patrols and escorts of ammunition to different stations. I took one load of ammunition, or went on the train with about four of us, and escorted a load of ammunition into Alexandria. And there, we went in, when we were free, we went into the Fleet Club in Alex. And we were allowed in. And we were in there one evening, and there was a program being broadcast to Australia over the radio. Of course, there was no television in those days. And while it was going on, there was the compere suddenly jumped on the stage, put his hand up. He was a naval officer. He had more makeup on than a woman. And then gave a declaration that all men would return to their camps, ships, and what have you, as Italy had declared war. Well, he didn't mention anything about us, by the way, so we just sat tight. And as the Matlows and Aussies was passing us, they was putting their bottles of beer that they hadn't drunk on our table. We were in for a good time until this officer came up and said, excuse me, chaps, this means you as well, you know. I don't know, he seemed as queer as a ninepenny piece to us, but there. So we had to return, and back we went. Of course, after a while, we got orders again, and we moved up to Merzimatru. Again, this was quite an experience because the Egyptian army was in all the positions in Merzimatru. Every one of their positions was lousy. We had to take over their pillboxes because there was pillboxes and defences around. They had anti-aircraft batteries there.
When you say lousy, you mean literally with lice?
Literally lousy, running with lice. Now, when we took over their guns in the pillboxes, they had no breech blocks in. We asked where they were, and the Egyptians pleaded ignorance. But after a little bit of persuasion, they disclosed where they'd buried the breech blocks, which we dug up and put back in the guns.
How did you persuade them?
Gentle persuasion. Either they told us or they got, this was unofficially done, but officially appreciated, I think.
Why were they hiding the breech box?
Well, because the Egyptians were on the side, really. They had their sympathies laid with Italy, in Germany. I mean, a lot of people don't know that King Farouk's palace at one time was surrounded by armoured cars to stop him from to stop him from getting out. Goodness knows what, but they had him surrounded because I think he did want to, at one time, evacuate himself over to the Itais. Just switch off a moment for you. Well, Mirza Batru was really well defended by us. We put down wire, hedgehogs. That was railway lines that we cut up and crossed them twice so that if a tank hit them, they just rolled. This is the first time they'd been used. We were attacked from the air by the Italians, who were quite good. They were quite good bombers because they... A lot of people think they were useless, but they were far from it. And we still had some of the Egyptian aircraft gunners there, and they would open up. But when the shells exploded, they were in the opposite direction of where the planes were coming from. So they were hocked out a bit quick. And our people took over. Now, Moesk at the time, Mirza Batru at the time, was the most bombed place in the whole of the hostilities because we were being bombed quite regular. But we still managed to have a bit of entertainment. We were bombed to such an extent that the REs came round to our positions and said that we had to strengthen our dugouts by putting a top on them, which we did with anything we could find and sandbags and, well, just making a thick top. The REs came round, inspected them and said, yeah, that one will stand a 250-pound bomb. That one will stand this. That one will stand that. They wouldn't have stood a grenade. This was proved when I received the situation report one morning, the fortress situation report, and it stated that 6 REs had been found that morning buried in their dugout. It had collapsed on top of them, killing them a lot. This, and these are the poor blighters that had said that our dugouts would withstand a bomb. Their own just collapsed under the weight of the material that was on top of them. Now, it was while we were in Mirza Batru that things began to warm up. We started to get ready for the first desert push. Patrols were going out, and coming back, we had a long-range desert group was formed. We had Popsky's private army. They were then in operation. Of course, Popsky, I don't know what nationality he was, but he had a long-range desert group of his own, and each man wore PPA on the lapel of his shirt. So that's what they called him, Popsky's private army. And then we also had what I think was the first commando unit of a war. They were made up of some of the toughest men in the British Army or whatever place they could get them from. They had a bush hat the same as the Australians wore, and their cap badge was a fanny. We called it a fanny. It was a killing knife about at least a foot long with a back-ended blade, and the front where the grip was knuckle dusters. This was one of their weapons. They were also equipped with the Tommy gun, American Tommy gun, and 45 automatics and what have you. Now this unit used to go into the desert, find Italian positions, and they would, if it was possible, they'd just do the lot, silently kill them all. And if it was a hut, as some of the Italian positions had in their back areas, like for anti-aircraft guns and that, they did have, they had the huts built there. These men would go into a hut. One would stand each end, and the others would go down either side, calmly cutting their throats. If a man was laying on his side, they'd just blow on his ear until he turned his head, and then cut his throat. When they left, they would leave a fanny stuck in the door. This, the Italians were absolutely terrified of them, and they even put a price on every man's head, and it was a dead certain that none would ever be captured. They were, if was there, any of them was anywhere near, they would have been killed. This unit was demobilized. For what reason? The only reason I can think of is they caused so much mayhem that they had to get rid of them. Nowhere can you find a cap badge, a fanny. I don't know if they've got one in the museum. I don't know if they've got one, the actual knife in the museum.
How did you learn these details about the commando unit?
Because some of them were our own men. Were our friends.
Who'd volunteered for it?
Who'd volunteered. Now, this unit was, well, it was done away with. They suddenly disappeared. Other units took their place, long-range desert groups. But I've seen no official record of this unit, and they were, in my opinion, the first commandos. Now we come...
Did they have a special name?
They did have a name, which I can't remember, but they could be identified by their cap badge. And
did many of your unit volunteer for them?
Well, we had odd men volunteered for everything. At the time, men were volunteering for the Royal Corps of Signals, for everything that was going. Well, to get out of the infantry in a lot of cases. We lost quite a few signalers that went into the Royal Corps of Signals. Some went into them. Some were Then we had some that were volunteering for various organisations that were on. Some did it for excitement. They thought they'd get more fun out of it. Because don't forget, at the time, the war was in its infancy. Infancy, I meant to say. I mean, even as the First Desert Campaign started, we were having a van coming up. It come up from Alexandria, and it used to go to the rear troops, and it used to sell tea, cakes, cigarettes, chocolate, and it was called the Come and Get It van. It had Come and Get It on. It was run by two Frenchmen. Well, this was during the desert push. One of the troops was leaning against the back of the van one day. It was like one of these transit vans, leaning against the back, drinking and eating a cup of tea and eating a wad. And he heard signals coming from it. And he was a signaler and recognised that his Morse code, reported it. And these Frenchmen had a transmitter in the back and was transmitting to the enemy. They disappeared. Don't know what happened to them. But Wavell, who was our general then, he was one of the most fantastic generals of the war. And if Churchill had let him have his way, the war would have been over a lot quicker in the desert. As I will tell you later on. Now, as things started to move up into the year, ready for the attack, we had an airfield at Meuse Mitrou with aircraft on it, windsock. But it was no aircraft. All the aircraft were made of tables, chairs, whatever we could, anything we could get hold of, and covered with sheets to make it look like aircraft. Lorries were used to make it look as if planes had been landing and taking off, so that when they filmed from the air, it looked as if the airport was in use. I used to bomb it quite regularly. Also, there was units went out in front of the Italian lines. The Italians then were at about City Brani. They would go out and they would have chains on the back of lorries, making a terrific din. They had recordings of tank movements during the night, and they would create a hell of a row where the Italians could hear it and then pull out. This was an idea of Wavell's. But when he attacked, he sent his tanks out into the desert and came round on the flank. Of course, it was thought the tanks couldn't go out into the desert then, but it had all been surveyed by the long-range desert groups, and they knew exactly what they could do. Now, there was quite a lot of stuff passing through Meuse Mitrou, and in one position there was a red cap on duty passing the he was doing, well, traffic control, passing the columns through. And of course we had been bombed quite a bit, put from the air, and he complained that he didn't have a slit trench, so they put a slit trench there for him. But at the time, although we're all preparing for attack, everything's moving up, there were still Egyptians coming up to look after some of their property that was in Mirza Matru, because there was hotels and it's a beautiful place. And there were some Egyptians there when this raid took place. Of course, this red cap had his slit trench and he dived straight in his slit trench. On top of him jumped a couple of Egyptians. The red cap broke his finger and became a casualty. And that was one of the biggest jokes there was in Mirza Matru, because that came as a signal, and we all had a good laugh at that. But when I said just now we had a bit of entertainment just before we started preparing for the big push, we used to go swimming in the bay. And we were down, there was about 500 men swimming one day. Not a bathing costume between the lot of them. And out on the point, because Mirza Matru is a beautiful bay, absolutely beautiful, with a spit coming round to make an entrance so that it's like a circle with a gap in where the ships or anything could come in. And on the end of this spit, we had a point where there was the observation point. Well, on there we had a flagpole, and that was the only notice we would have of air raids. There was no equipment for picking up the sound of aircraft. And when they spotted aircraft coming, they would put up the red flag. Well, there was all these men swimming, and an air raid came over. They started dropping their bombs in the water all over. Well, everybody dived out, and they're all dumping into the bomb craters that were already all over the beach. There was one group of men that were being trained on first aid on the sand. They were all training, and one of them, the things they were using was a Thompson splint, which is like a cage which you put over a broken leg. I don't know if you've seen one. Now, they had one patient lady with this Thompson splint over his leg as the raid started. And as the bomb started to drop, everybody jumped into the holes, the bomb, any cover they could get, including the man with the Thompson splint. But he got hit, and he received a broken leg. But it wasn't the one that had the splint on, so they had to take the splint off his good leg and put it onto his bad one. There was also one man, Tim's his name was,